Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back to our conversations. We're about to have a conversation with Lobsang Sangay, who is the newly elected prime minister of Tibet, and known in Tibetan as the Kalon Tripa.
Yeah.
And Mr. Prime Minister, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Mark Steiner, to be on your show.
This is interesting in so many different ways, because let's first describe for our listeners, most of whom I'm sure are aware of Tibet and the Dalai Lama, that what it means to be elected a president of a nation in exile, which is really what happened here, correct?
Yes. There is a Tibetan government in exile, which is called Central Tibetan Administration, located in a hilly town called Dharamsala in India. It functions like any other government, with three branches, executive, legislature, and judiciary, which try civil cases, and parliament meet twice a year. And then the executive branch has seven major ministries like foreign, education, health, finance. So it's like any other government, and it has anywhere from 450 full-time and 700 or so part-time or contract basis employees. So it's an effective functioning government which provides welfare services. For example, I studied in one of the refugee schools in India, and hundreds, at times thousands of Tibetans flee from Tibet to come to India to seek education, and we provide them for free. In addition, we also provide them, knowledge about Tibetan history, culture, language, so that Tibetans could preserve our own identity and sense of dignity to sustain the freedom movement in exile.
So you yourself were born in India, you were born in Darjeeling, India, the child of Tibetan refugees who fled in 1959, is that correct?
Yes. My father and mother were from eastern part of Tibet, and my father fought as part of the guerrilla group to resist the Chinese Red Army's invasion, and he got wounded, and finally he managed to escape to India. But his family had some tragic experience. For example, his sister was paraded in her village because she was associated with quote-unquote rebel. She had to endure weekly humiliation during Cultural Revolution, which she could not tolerate. And she was pregnant and with her infant child in hand, she jumped into a river and committed suicide. And she was trying to drag along her young son, who kind of managed to free himself. And now he's in India as a monk. From her mother's side, her brother was sent back, or he went back to fight and never returned, so he got killed. My father and mother finally, after the escape from Tibet in 1959, met in Darjeeling. That's where I was born, in a small refugee community. So I grew up with cows, with 1 acre of land, dozen or so chicken, and my parents sold one of their cows to send me to a refugee school. That's how I started my education, and so here I am, leaving Harvard University after 15 years and returning to serve Tibet and Tibetan people.
You were the first Tibetan to go to the Harvard Law School.
Yes, first among 6 million, yes.
And this is interesting on so many levels. I mean, first of all, the Dalai Lama, who the world knows, decided no longer to be the political leader of the Tibetan people, but to leave this open to a democratic election among Tibetan exiles from across the world to elect their own prime minister. Is that right?
Yes. So, it has been a gradual process in the sense he has been delegating his political power over 50 years. But then on 10th March of this year, which we also observe as our National Uprising Day, that's when we have the massive uprising against Chinese occupation in 1959, he made a public announcement saying he is going to devolve all his political power to elected leader who will represent and Tibetan people as their political spokesman and political leader. And it was very competitive but healthy election, and people supported me overwhelmingly.
It's very curious. I mean, on many levels, and I mean the Tibetan world and the Tibetan Buddhist world, for years before the Chinese took over, and for the hundreds of years of its existence, was a theocracy run by men, and over the centuries, and so but now we're seeing something has happened since the kind of Chinese takeover and the exile of the Dalai Lama, and to this point we are now in 2011, where this old kind of patriarchal theocracy, in a very deeply spiritual place, is now has been touched by and is kind of uniting in a way with the democratic principles of the West. Could you talk a bit about that? That I find fascinating.
Yes, Tibet was what I call aristocratic, theocratic system, meaning a group of monks and aristocrats were the ruling elite, and then obviously over masses. The institution of Dalai Lama started to govern Tibet since 1642. Since coming to exile, His Holiness introduced a democratic system, which means since 1960 we have been electing our member of parliament. And in 1990, the parliament was expanded and empowered, and in 2001 we had first direct election of the prime minister. An overwhelming majority of Tibetans elected a lama or monk as the prime minister. This time, the people voted overwhelmingly, and all three, the final candidates were all lay people or secular people, and they voted for a young, secular, American-educated youth, which happens to be me. So there's a drastic transition from historical point of view. The institution of Dalai Lama as we know it is changing, and the historical system which we had has evolved dramatically, and this time taking a major transformation. And then I just happen to be also someone who's born and brought up in exile, is taking over the top leadership, which also is for the first time. And this all because His Holiness Dalai Lama believes in the principles of democracy and freedom. And, he magnanimously decided to devolve all his political power and empower the political leadership to be the spokesman and leader of the Tibetan people.
How does that fit into also his kind of going against the grain of tradition? I believe it's pronounced the Made Tolku, the finding the next Dalai Lama, which usually happens when a Dalai Lama passes, and they look for a child that is a reincarnation of Dalai Lama. But he's looking for a that reincarnation now. That's also kind of a switch with a change from the traditions of the past.
That is true. I think the way it goes is the traditional process of reincarnation is a lama passes away, then we look for a young infant or a boy normally to be the next reincarnated lama. So that is the conventional process. Having said that, there is also a practice of Made Tolku, which means a lama will appoint his own successor while he is alive. So with His Holiness Dalai Lama, he was asked about different kinds of reincarnation, and he shared different ways one could find reincarnation, one of which was Made Tolku. And I, for one, endorse that idea and support the idea that His Holiness appoints his own successor while he's very much alive, because we want the 15th Dalai Lama to be like this present Dalai Lama, a brilliant leader who has led us very well, and who better than him to designate his own successor and train him, educate him, give him guidance while he's alive. So that's what I support. Having said that, if His Holiness Dalai Lama decides to, you know, follow the conventional process or any other procedure, I support that as well. And because His Holiness is the ultimate authority on who his successor or next reincarnation should be.
So the Tibet is controlled by China. There was a rebellion just a couple of years ago that was put down. The Chinese are repopulating Tibet with Han people, the Chinese people themselves, changing the face of Tibet. So, and this Dalai Lama and the Tibetan people, many Tibetan people have been in exile for since 1959. So, what will you be doing as the new prime minister to address the issues inside of Tibet, and how can you, from exile, what effect do you think you can have?
As you pointed out, Tibet is under an occupation, and there's cultural assimilation, political repression, economic marginalization, and environmental destruction. For example, to have a picture of Dalai Lama, you will go to jail. Even if you have a copy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, then that in itself is not a crime, but that will label you as potential threat, and you'll be in trouble. And Tibetans, even though they have high school or college degrees, 40% or so, they don't get jobs because of influx of Chinese migrants who have moved in to Tibet and marginalizing Tibetans and making Tibetans, you know, second-class citizens in their own homeland. And then there are a lot of, even in the capital city of Lhasa, you will find Chinese military personnel with automatic machine guns, sharpshooters of rooftops. So it is under undeclared martial law. That's really tragic. Having said that, and my own past painful family legacy, my parents' family legacy, and His Holiness, experience, a very tragic experience he was forced to flee Tibet. The official policy of Tibetan government exile is to seek genuine autonomy within the framework of the Chinese constitution, which means we are not challenging China's sovereignty or territorial integrity, and we believe in nonviolence and peace, and we are willing to have dialogue with the Chinese government anytime, anywhere.
So I'm curious how you would implement. One of the things I read in your campaign speeches as you were running to become the prime minister of Tibet, and you do see yourself as the prime minister of Tibet, not just of the Tibetan exile world, correct?
Yes. We represent Tibet inside and outside Tibet.
Now, did any Tibetans inside Tibet get a chance to vote, even secretly, for you?
They could not, unfortunately, but given a choice, they would. But they have voted indirectly or informally, because during the preliminary round, final round, and the day the election result was declared, Tibetans, as per the tradition, went to monasteries, offered prayers, butter lambs, you know, and the firecrackers, and even some artists actually composed songs in honor of the election result and the democratic processes. So, you know, given a choice, they would have definitely participated and voted for Tibetans, voted for the Kalantripa as well. And as for the dialogue, I have a track record of reaching out to Chinese students and scholars. While at Harvard for the last 15 years, I've organized 7 major conferences and many other meetings between Chinese students and Tibetan students. 7 major conferences included scholars coming all the way from Beijing, from Shanghai, even from Lhasa, and exiled Tibetan scholars from Dharamsala, Europe, and America, including 2 between His Holiness Dalai Lama and 35 Chinese scholars in 2003, and His Holiness Dalai Lama and 100 or so Chinese scholars in 2009. So I have track record of reaching out to Chinese scholars and organizing successful conferences. That's the approach I'm going to continue and reach out to as many Chinese students, people, and scholars as much as possible.
You also said that you will, we'll talk about in a minute, meet the needs of the community in exile, that you want to confront the Chinese government's policies in Tibet and engage with the Chinese people. How do you intend to do that?
Sure. The injustice that is taking place in Tibet, for example, in a place called Ngaba, there's the Kirti Monastery, which is under siege because one monk set himself on fire to protest against the painful occupation of the China. Instead of putting out the fire, Chinese policemen beat him up, and thereafter he died. And then the Chinese policemen moved in to clamp down on the monastery. The local people, Tibetans, surrounded the monastery. There was a standoff, and from reports, what we hear is that now more than 300 monks are arrested. Some got beaten up, tortured. This is one example of the tragedy in Tibet. So we'll confront this kind of injustice. We'll point it out to the rest of the world and say, this is what's happening in Tibet. It ought to end. But we believe in nonviolence. We believe in peace, and we believe in dialogue. That's how we want to resolve it. If the Chinese government is willing, we will have dialogue anytime they want. At the same time, we are going to reach out to Chinese people and inform them the reality, the tragic reality, and tell them and suggest that we ought to sit and understand the situation and ought to end this situation peacefully in the best interest of both Chinese and Tibetan people.
Now, while your father was a guerrilla warrior inside of Tibet, you have chosen to confront the Chinese and look for Tibetan independence, or at least Tibetan self-determination, through nonviolence.
Yes, my father, yes, he was brave. I admire his bravery, but he was fighting a losing battle in the sense, even now, we Tibetans have around 6 million population, and the Chinese army accounts for around 2.5 million young, PLA soldiers with automatic machine guns. So violence doesn't seem to be an option at all. So I do believe in nonviolence, and I support the Tibetan government's policy, which is genuine autonomy within China.
Do you think that's achievable, given this, the power and the determination of the Chinese government to not let go of anything they think belongs to them?
If they think rationally, we should. One, yes, they're right. China has power, military power, and financial power. But what they don't have is moral power. Mm. If they want to be the next superpower or the second superpower in this world, they ought to have moral authority. As long as they trample on Tibetans the way they are doing now, they will not gain moral authority. You cannot gain respect with military force or money power. You have to earn it. The way you earn it is to treat people respectfully. Till the Chinese government does not treat Tibetans with their due dignity and identity, China's image will be tarnished forever. So it is in the best interest of China to have moral authority, to be a respectful power, that they ought to solve the issue of Tibet peacefully.
One of the things that people say about the 21st century is that one of the sources of power and the sources of conflict will be over water, and that Tibet, beyond the reasons that China may have attacked Tibet and taken it over in the 1950s. Is the fact that Tibet is the source of water for most of Asia, for China, for Southeast Asia, for India. It is the water source. How much do you think that plays into all of this?
Definitely. You're absolutely right. Tibet, as a territory, is 2.5 million square kilometers, which is as big as Texas and California combined. Also, it has major rivers, as you pointed out. The major rivers in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, China, all the way to Vietnam and Thailand, Mekong River, you know, flows from Tibet. And water is going to be that's a major source of dispute, as it is between Pakistan and India, and now between India and China and Bangladesh. So all the water, major rivers of that part of the world comes from Tibet. Essentially, we can claim that we feed about, you know, half the population of the world.
Right.
And then, you know, so far, China is drinking our water for free and not reciprocating in kind to give us our own, you know, autonomy. And their natural resources as well. There are reports of uranium, gold. The second largest copper mine in China is in Tibet. The rainforest. So it is, you know, a country with a lot of resources. And no wonder China calls Tibet Xinjiang. China calls Tibet Xizang, which means Western treasure.
Hmm. That it is. Now, you are also, as the newly elected prime minister, or Kalan Tripa in Tibetan, of Tibet, you're governing the exile community, which
yes.
is far-flung. A lot of it's in India, but Tibetans live in the United States. They live in France. They live all over. I mean, what will it mean as prime minister for the Tibetan people who you will have direct interaction with, who are the exile community?
Yes, I think it became very clear during the election, because Tibetans are scattered in 30 different countries, from Australia to Alaska, you know, New Delhi to New York, and Europe in between.
And here in Baltimore as well.
Definitely included, from Baltimore to Boston.
Right.
I agree with you. And, you know, so I had to travel quite a lot. And some places which I could not reach, I reach out to them through our website, you know. So definitely. And then, but the Tibetans in diaspora, they all participated in this election. This was the most energetic, excited, dynamic, competitive election in our exile history. So all of them participated, and they voted one way or the other. And because of the fact that I got the overwhelming mandate, I think Tibetans in exile do accept me as their leader.
And today you take off in just a couple of hours, less than 2 hours, you take off to fly to Dharamsala, India, to assume your position as Prime Minister of Tibet.
Definitely. Should I say this will be the last or the first, you know, interview before I go to Dharamsala and prepare to take over the post of Kalan Tripa, or the head of the administration in Dharamsala?
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world and congratulate you on this election, and wish you and the Tibetan people all the luck in the world, Lobsang Sangay, the new Prime Minister of Tibet.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's really good to be on your show.
It's been an honor to have you. Thank you so much. Travel safe and good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.